Okay, that's great. If I can come to Ed, you particularly might raise some points about looking ahead and potentially managing options. And then if I can ask you to touch on fundraising considerations, then I'm going to come to some of the questions that are indeed appearing in the chat. So, Ed, if I may.
Probably just expanding on what I said earlier on, reviewing the client's pension position, how that can help support funding a whole of life policy, managing the income tax impacts of that. So it's trying to bring everything into the round. Like Ross, I use Voyant. I bring everything together. It's making sure everything is aligned. And if a client has a pension which isn't being used for any other purpose, and obviously is going to have an impact if it's left intact from April 27 onwards, and actually biting the bullet on it, taking a tax-free cash out, which could potentially be gifted or invested in business relief, and drawing some kind of income to fund the whole of life policy. And as a dual benefit of that income being treated as surplus income. So the payments to cover the premium are not treated as gifts. So that helps again the whole inheritance tax position. But you know, that's one of several things. And just going back to Ross's point about whole of life guaranteed, reviewable, and also considering term, every client's going to be different, and it's working through, you know, what the risks are, as he clearly demonstrated, and working out in some cases actually whether it's better just to have a term policy and say, right, there's a finite time for you to plan. So it gives you 10, 15, 20 years. The cost is a bit less, potentially a lot less than whole of life. But, you know, if I have to understand that at the end of the term, they might not be able to get cover again. So it's weighing a few things up, and it's usually a few different options combined to make it work and make it right for the client.
Okay, if I can come to questions from the audience. Nick, sorry, I don't have a surname for you, but you put three or four comments in the chat. Could I invite you to come on and bring those various comments together? Anything that you think we haven't covered already? Just
Yeah,
give you
hi
a moment.
everyone.
Hello.
Hopefully you can hear me okay. So yeah, I was
Yeah.
actually was going to Harry's point that he made earlier about setting up multiple trusts. And I just really wanted to check my understanding of that. I kind of get the RICEF principles. However, is this not essentially a moot point because of the same day addition rules? So in
Harry,
the
if you'd like.
event of death, you know, the life provider is going to be paying out, let's say, three lots of 300,000. I thought in order for this to be effective, that it would the additions need to be settled into the trust on different days as well. Otherwise, they get added together. The purposes of the periodic charges and the entry charges and that.
My understanding from Royal London and a couple of other different people, and as a from a trust point of view, is that if you set up a policy on different dates, then you only have the £325,000 per trust.
Yeah, that was so that initially that was my understanding as well, was to set up three trusts on three different days. But I thought the government brought in some anti-avoidance legislation a few years ago, which was in relation to same day additions, where the money actually settled into the trust also needs to be on three different days. Obviously, the client will only die once, so is it just one date that is considered, or could we speak to the life provider and ask them to pay out the money on three different days in order to avoid that piece of legislation?
I think that's something from my point of view. I feel that it's not about when it's paid out, it's when it's set up, the trust is set up
Okay.
on the basis. Now, I've spoken to Zurich, I've spoken to Royal London, I've spoken to a few different, I've spoken to most insurance companies about this principle. They publicize it on their websites, and I've also talked to some independent trust practitioners, and they seem to agree with me. In on a sort of basis.
That's great. Thank you, Harry. Appreciate that.
Okay, great. Could I come to Anthony Heather? Again, you've raised, I think, two or three questions in the chat. Which ones of your questions have we not answered yet?
So look, we've had lots of discussions. This pension thing, particularly in the business relief, has really brought it onto the agenda for clients, hasn't it? They've never been more interested. So we've got a number, we're thinking about a number of big whole of life contracts. And I'm thinking, do I want the complication of splitting these into three or to four when it's a million? When ultimately the point of it is to pay the IHT bill in the end. Because I think if you're splitting them, you are going to, and they're discretionary trusts, you are going to have some complications with periodic and exit charges, I think. And I'm not sure in all honesty, I fully understand the implications. That's my battle with myself at the moment.
Anyone care to pick up on that?
I'm happy to, again, if you want me to.
Please, Harry, yeah. Right.
I think that's the reason why we're advisors. You know, we're not, I don't pretend to be just a product salesperson. I try and do as much research. I've actually tried many a time. This is where I think the insurance providers lack educating us. You know, they should know about what the tax implications are and stuff like that. Also, I think when you look at the process holistically, what's to stop the client just taking the money out and just leave a loan in the trust so the money doesn't grow?
There's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. So it's how clever we are. I think there's a headache of setting up three policies as opposed to one. And it's a little bit more expensive because, again, I think the last time I spoke on this, I mentioned to Ian that insurance companies don't support you on this sort of principle, which is totally against the principles of looking after our clients. And again, I've spoken to every single company, insurance company, they're not interested. They just want sales. And this is where I think that they don't support us. I think there's lots of challenges in terms of setting it up in the way I've mentioned. But I think the benefit is enormous for our clients. It's not enormous for us. It's hard work for us. It's enormous for our clients. And if you're able to do that and you're able to save one or two generations worth of inheritance tax, just imagine what you've done. And you've earned nothing out of it, really, because you've stopped having the next generation having another life insurance policy and the next generation and stuff like that, maybe two generations of thing. Now, that to me is phenomenal.
You know, I mean, Harry, for the next generations, you're not really saving the IHT, are you? You're deferring it.
Well, no, because if you've taken a loan out,
that
loan is going to pay, it's going to go back into their estate, so the value isn't going to be yet. So that money is being used over and over and over again until the 125 years are up.
But in theory, that should come back in at some point, and I'm not sure if it ever will. I mean,
125 years down the road, maybe. 125 years down the road.
It comes
into your estate. And that's you know, the trust before weren't 125 years, a lot longer. And that's what I'm saying to, that's what I would like to convey, is the education that we have is lacking enormously. As a chartered tax planner, chartered financial advisor and a trust and estate practitioner who've gone through the qualifications at the same level of charter, I still am not 100% because I'm looking for verification from these different people. And the insurance companies are not there to support us. They're interested in just having that money, the premiums coming through. They're not interested in supporting a good financial planner or a good protection provider, specialist, to sort of say, what can we do help our clients?
Yeah. I mean, if it's any help to all the guys out there, it does seem that Royal London's policy charges are lower. So when you start splitting it, the total cost tends to come in lower with the Royal London compared to the Zurich and LNG and things, which I think when you're splitting it into multiple policies, there's a higher differential, if you know what I mean. Royal London are cheaper when you've got multiple, but you just have to do the numbers.
So I think really interesting points being raised there about lack of provider support. Something that's been occurring to me a lot recently is there does seem to be a lack of understanding these days amongst the manufacturer community of practically what an advisor does. Yes, they are very revenue driven, and it does make me wonder, is Consumer Duty really quite having the impact that it should do? I'm going to come back to Nick because you put your hand up, wanted to raise another point. And then I'm going to come to Tim Morris, if I may.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. It was just really following on from your comment there, Harry, about borrowing from the trust. The off-the-shelf kind of, I mentioned this in the chat, but the off-the-shelf trusts that are provided by life offices, do they typically allow for borrowing from the trust, or do you see us maybe having closer relationships with solicitors whereby they're, you know, drawing up more personalised deeds?
Oh, Harry, I think you've muted yourself.
I guess that question's back to me again. I don't like, so if you think about how many life insurance actually pays out of 100, I don't know, maybe 10, maybe 15, because people continue to change. If you're then trying to set up a trust from an external company, they'll charge you about £100-£125, whatever the cost is regarding that. What I found out was that just like a will, after death, you can change the construction of a will within 2 years. What a lot of people don't know is you can do exactly the same with a trust. What that basically means, that's what my understanding is if you have the agreement of all the trustees, you can change the construction of the trust. What that means is you can actually use a life insurance policy, and when, and again, you'd tell the client this, when the life insurance is paid out, you would end up employing a trust lawyer at that time. To me, that's much more sensible to do than to actually set up these trusts from outside the life insurance companies. Because I think most of the life insurance trusts are quite decent. They're not specific. What you'd want is the specific trust to be taken into account at the point of that death, because then you're looking at the individual as opposed to the generic. That's okay. What my understanding is.
Yeah, so I see what you're saying. So essentially, you know, using the life offices, you know, off-the-shelf trusts that they provide, and then at the time where the money settled into the trust, at that stage you could apply to change the terms of the trust to allow for loans if it didn't already cater for it.
Yeah,
within 2 years of death. Yeah, okay, great. I didn't know that. That's really useful. Thank you.
Can I come to Ed for a moment to ask you, in your notes you made some really valid points about income funding and funding considerations, and also exploring whole of life versus term to 90. But just before that, going back to Harry's point about 125 years later, I've just had a quick look up in terms of the inflation effect. £1 in 1900 would be equivalent to £155 today. So if we have deferred a tax liability, in real terms, it will be great. Assuming inflation follows the pattern of the last 125 years, it will be greatly reduced. Ed, if I can come back to you on those points of income and funding considerations and whole of life versus term to 1990.
It's pretty much what I said earlier. It's weighing up whether this liability is going to be remaining for the rest of their lives, or whether they plan to do something about it during their lifetime. Unfortunately, or fortunately for most, they're going to still have their property, which is going to be a massive part of their estate. Unless they're looking to offload that, then there will be some form of residual liability, which is likely to be with them for the rest of their lives. So that's where a whole of life will probably fit. But there's also the cost issue as well. One of the things I found useful, and I'm sure hopefully most of the people on this call will be aware of this stuff, is getting these projections, comparisons of what is the actual cost of whole of life over your lifetime So you have a premium, you know how much the cover is, versus if you put that same amount into some form of investment within a trust from day one, what's the kind of crossover point? So where is it that, you know, how long do you need to live before the whole of life policy becomes poor value? And that's really helpful. And you can add in, you know, assumed investment returns or whatever. And you can show a client that actually they need to live to 104 or whatever it might be before the whole of life policy becomes poor value, which again is just embedding to the client, yes, this is a cost, but actually versus alternative options, there's good value to doing it. So it's another way of looking at whole of life, which hopefully, because I think when you mention life insurance to clients, they just see it as, you know, a dead cost. They're just paying for something which they never hopefully have to use, but obviously everyone's going to die. So with whole of life, it's actually quite important to show what is a potential cost over their lifetime. And obviously if they live for a very long period of time, that's the only point where it becomes poor value. Whereas we know, you know, for most people, we use the average life expectancy, the ONS assumptions for that, and that can help clarify the total cost.
Feels that to makes me sense. Like it doesn't. It feels to me like there's some very interested, more sophisticated planning and value for money tools that the cash flow planning providers could potentially be building into more sophisticated versions of their software.
Just as a couple of examples of that, Royal London and Zurich both offer these tools. I think Royal London is on their website, and you can just plug in, right, you've got the, you know, reviewable versus guaranteed. You can plug in what the potential costs are, the amount of cover you're looking for, and their ages, and then you can show the comparison. And it's a great way of illustrating it to a client.
That's great. If I can come, Anthony, Heather, you made a point about insurance companies, trusts, and the risk of trustees falling out with trustees.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that a bit? Because, you know, this whole question of, well, financial harm is another situation we've covered previously in these sessions. But if you could expand.
Yeah. Okay. So we think we know our clients quite well, but there's nothing quite like death to bring out the different sides in people. And we've had some scenarios where the children have been trustees and they have fallen out in a major way and nothing can happen because the trustees have to agree unanimously to take any action. You know, if you want to sack trustees, trustees have to agree in unanimity. So these whole of life trusts don't have protector. The ability to appoint a protector, as far as I can see. We use Quilter quite a lot, and their lifestyle trust is one of these bond reversions where you can take the money back. The settlor can take the money back every year, and it's all out of the estate. After 7 years, that has a protector provision, you know, allowing that protector to sack a trustee. But again, what do you do? You just have to write your own trust and go to Solidus or somebody like that and get a, or Countrywide is it, and get a pay for trust yourself.
Certainly an interesting question for advisors to consider. Rikesh Bhatt, you've put a number of comments in the chat. I probably should have come to you earlier. Apologies. Which ones have we not got to of the points that you've raised, sir?
No, so I've had some really helpful comments in the chat in terms of clarification on whether these whole of life premiums, especially big chunky premiums, count as chargeable lifetime transfers. And so if they do, a case I'm actually working on, we're actually establishing a combination of an actual loan trust and an actual whole of life policy. And what I'm thinking is, can both the loan trust and the whole of life exist in the same trust so that we could take a 5% withdrawal from the loan trust. It stays within the trust and funds a whole of life premium so we don't get caught by CLT rules. Thoughts?
Any further thoughts on that from any of our panelists in their experience?
Other than only, that's a great question. I have no idea, but it's a great question.
But yeah, I mean, I think probably not. It sounds like it's skirting around too many tax issues. So I suspect not, but it might be some kind of, you know, product development that could be taken on by one of the more kind of sophisticated life companies, but I'm not sure. There was a life company some time ago, which is a Luxembourg-based one, where they allowed you to take out life cover within an investment bond. So it was funded within the bond, but I don't know whether that's still the case now.
Okay, fine. The other question I could do some clarification on. We often say that, look, if there's a significant IHT liability over the course of time, their client may become more and more comfortable shifting. And so as a result of that, in actual practical use, how easy is it to be able to reduce the sum assured in future? And what impact does that have on the premiums?
Certainly with a reviewable whole of life policy, you get that natural break point at the review date, which is going to be 10 years and then every 5 years thereafter, where you're given the choice of, do you want to reduce your sum assured? But I think even with the guaranteed rates, you can go to your insurer and ask them. They're not obligated to do it. But you can go to the insurer and ask about reducing the sum assured and reducing the premiums as well. So I think there is a bit of flexibility built in there to account for changes in people's circumstances. But we need to also, again, just think about the practicalities of gifting and using that as a way of reducing the estate. So it gifting away assets. Well, first of all, it's very difficult to gift away illiquid assets. So if your main IHT liability becomes from the house that you live in, or properties that you own, then there's all sorts of other complications to gifting and giving it away, and you trigger capital gains tax, which otherwise would have been wiped out on death. So are you willing to trigger capital gains tax to try and avoid inheritance tax? And does that make sense? Giving away assets which you would have otherwise drawn down on to fund your own lifestyle. So you're then depriving yourself of the ability to fund your lifestyle in order to avoid inheritance tax, which I've never been a fan of. I think that you really need to look after yourself first and foremost. So actually giving assets away, yes, that might work, but you've got to look at the individual circumstances of the client before you can just say, well, what we'll do is we'll reduce your IHT liability by giving away some of your assets, because it won't be practical for everybody.
Can I just add on to that? If you did, let's say, three policies at £300,000, you can knock one on the head as opposed to doing one whole one.
I think it possibly might be Zurich, but certainly one of the or two of the life companies do have carve out. If you have a whole of life policy and you give away an asset, it is possible to carve out part of a cover and convert it into a gift into VIVOS. Now, I can't remember the detail of that, but I do know it's available from some. So that might be worth bearing in mind as well.